It's always sad that they have to lower the mic every time I get on stage. Well, I want to thank you for inviting me over here. I came from Dublin on Friday, and I've been having a very quiet, peaceful time in London. And I'm going to read from my third novel, or as they say in Ireland, my third novel, Baby Zero. And it's quite a complicated novel, and I'll just give you a bit of context before I jump into it. I'm going to read from three different bits. Can you hear me all right? Is that okay? I'm getting a funny echo.
Yeah, I think it's the other one.
I thought it was the voices in my head. So, Baby Zero, that's even worse. I'm just echoing all over the place.
Keep going.
Well, Baby Zero, its underlying themes are, I guess it's the struggle against reductive thinking, that in it the world is gripped by Eastern and Western fundamentalism. And it did come from a very personal place. I was living in California, my husband was Iranian, and we were living with his Iranian family. So in a way it was my revenge novel against my in-laws, which is always great to be a writer for that reason. And in reality, I noticed that there was no clash of civilizations, because when you saw it, that Bush and the Taliban had far more in common with each other than they had with most average people in either of those cultures, that they were both extremists, they didn't tolerate difference, and they insisted that their traditions, however exploitive, of women, gays, artists, or anybody constituted as other, were written in stone and, you know, vindicated by the respective Bibles. So, you know, I was thinking, do we really want a globe with one species, one language, one culture? And I don't think most of us do. So I wrote it because it's an Eastern novel in some ways. I wrote it in that tradition, like the 1001 Arabian Nights. It's a story within a story within a story. And there's the story of the woman in the prison in Iraq, and within that story there's the story of Layla and Zolo arriving in America. And within that story, there's the story of the genocide of the indigenous people in California. So, but primarily this book, I suppose, is about listening to the other, that Layla can come thousands of miles away from a refugee camp, and when she arrives in California, she can feel the story of the first people who ever inhabited the land. And she's like the princess and the pea. She can feel the ghosts rising through all those layers of history. And then she knows that if she keeps telling their story, that they're not gone, they're not forgotten. So it's about the power of the story. And how if we listen to other people's stories, we don't demonize them so fast. And in the end, in the other, in a rap, Marguerite realizes that by telling Layla's story, that her life really means something. So I'm going to just pick a couple of pages from each selection, just to give you an idea of each of the parts of the book. Is that okay? Am I still reverbing weirdly all over the place? Very surreal. I'll try it now. Hello? Everybody's gone. All my other personalities have just disappeared like that. Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah, it's still there, but not exactly.
If I stand away, can you hear me like this? Can you hear me at the back like that?
Yeah.
And it doesn't echo as much, does it?
No.
Okay. Okay. This is the part where Zolo and Layla arrive in America. And they've been, there's been a revolution, they've lost their country, and they've arrived, they've come from a refugee camp, and their parents have sent them into the very bad hands of their uncle, who is a bachelor plastic surgeon living in California and has no idea how to deal with children. The two children sat in the sky, immaculate, blameless, not in control. When they touched down, winter just fell away. They were stunned, as if the world had started turning the other way. Los Angeles sunshine, pure, golden, banging off the walls, sending the sky up even higher. Zolo and Layla saw their Uncle Mo at the airport. They ran to him and he threw his arms around them. He took their one suitcase and he led them towards the car. I'm setting up a clinic here, so I'm very busy. You two are old enough to entertain yourselves, so get yourselves organized. What age are you now, Zolo? 17. When I was 17, I was putting myself through college. My parents gave me nothing. They were still beating me with a stick. And my grandmother was beating them with the same implement. They say you're gifted, Zolo. You'll do medicine, no doubt. Follow me into my clinic. Cosmetic surgery is the way to go here. These Americans are so stupid, and the Europeans who make it over here are even dumber and richer and uglier than Americans. My gift is to see ugliness everywhere. Layla was trailing behind, blinking in the sunshine, very hot in all her layers of clothes. Zolo stopped in irritation to wait for her. Mo walked on ahead at a brisk pace. Come on, Zolo, he threw the suitcase into the trunk of his Lincoln. You'll go to USC, University of Spoiled Children. You'll fit right in. You must get the forms and all that. I don't have the time to help you. Remember your father used to bring you into the surgery and stand you on a crate to watch the operations? Layla was removing her coat and her sweaters. Mo appraised her for the first time. She's pretty, your sister. We'll find her a good husband, a doctor. She's a bit flat-chested. They don't like that here, but we can fix that, can't we? You and I, Zolo? Zolo frowned. I'm 13, Uncle Mo. Layla's 10. Mo was already in the car, searching all his pockets for the key. Layla and Zolo climbed in. Mo was lost in thought. Then he said, almost to himself, 10. Well, my mother was married at 10, a mother at 13. That's nature's way. If your father had listened to me, he wouldn't be in the mess he's now. He's ruined you all, running about after his queens and princes. They were just a jumped-up military family with no royal blood. Thugs, American and British puppets. And this new bunch in control now will be worse. Orapa's always had governments that went out of their way to kill their own people. Uncle Mo, Layla leaned in between the seats nervously. When will you get Mama and Baba over? She knew he heard her because he flexed his hands on the wheel in irritation. Mo grabbed Zolo's nose and pulled it hard. Zolo flew forward, his arms flapping and his hands trying to peel his uncle's hairy fingers away. This is becoming quite a conk, Zolo. I'll take the end off it next week if I've time, okay? Then he glanced at Layla. God knows what's going to appear on her face in a few years' time. Mo left them off at his beachfront house in Malibu. To Layla and Zolo, it looked like a blue wooden shack. They walked inside in a disappointed daze. He'd owned a mansion in Arap. There was only one bedroom and a living room with a kitchen counter in the middle. Zolo went onto the deck to look at the Pacific Ocean. The deck was bigger than the house. Unlike all the neighboring decks, it had no plants, no chairs, no table. I'm tired, Layla complained, lingering at the French doors. You have jet lag, Zolo was delighted to inform her. Will I get better? No, it's fatal. Uncle, why is your house so small? Mo twisted about in rage. Small? This is fucking Malibu. Do you know how much this costs? Do you have any idea where you are? No, she doesn't, Zolo said. She's just a little frog. Layla slunk away from the doors and sat on a big black leather L-shaped couch. Mo drew his nephew into an embrace. Zolo, you've great things ahead of you. There are opportunities in America you've never dreamed of. This lousy revolution was the best thing that ever happened to you. Mark my words. The doorbell rang. Mo swept into the front room and opened the door. Suddenly a woman with blonde hair and a red leather jacket stood framed in the light. The woman smiled nervously at the children. Mo was opening drawers in the kitchen part of the room. In a frenzy, he threw boxes on the counter and put on white gloves. Zolo, come and observe. You can learn a thing or two. He beamed at the woman. Rita, this is my young apprentice. When I have my surgery up and running, he'll be the heir to it all. We'll work side by side as I did with his dear father. Rita took off her jacket. She was very tanned and she wore a tank top and she looked like she knew where to sit and what to do. When she was sitting firmly on a stool by the counter, Mo came with a needle and injected it straight into her forehead. What is it? Zolo was entranced. Botox, a form of toxin that causes botulism. Technically, it's a poison. Layla looked over when she realized this woman was being killed. A frost formed beneath her skin. It paralyzes the facial muscles and you don't use your face. As a result, you don't get wrinkles. "You don't get old," Rita managed to say to Zolo as she clasped a cool compressor on her forehead. "Oh, you get old, all right," Mo winked, "but your forehead will stay young." "I wanted to ask you about alloderm, Mo." "Well, look, Rita, I'll have the surgery up and running soon. The injectables aren't the answer. You can't beat a good facelift. Alloderm is taken from corpses. I can fold it, roll it, stack it, and it'll fit into your face. It'll become you. But 5 years from now, when your jaw drops," he patted her jaw and slid his finger down her neck, "and when your neck becomes a real turkey gobbler, and when I'm pulling your skin during the operation, the filler will still be in it and won't move anywhere. You'll be left with a big lump. Other doctors will do it, but I have scruples, Rita. Just keep getting Botox every 2 months, and after the surgery, we'll use it to fill it out any lines." Then he kissed her. She smiled at him, and he touched her lips. "I need some more bovine collagen, don't I?" Rita said eagerly. Rita wrote Mo a check, and he saw her to a car. Zola whispered to Layla, "He doesn't have a clinic, the old bastard." Mo showed Zolo how to clear the counter. He then took some pasta from a plastic Tupperware container and microwaved it. There was a Tupperware box with a white sticker that read "Lark's Tongues," and he shook them onto the pasta. He never thought to offer them any food. "Rita is addicted to this stuff. I charge only $300. Till I get my surgery, word of mouth. I do it here. Easy money, Zolo. I might marry Rita. I need an American passport. You have to find a born-again Christian. That's what she is. They're the most stupid people in America. LA is the good life, Zolo. You'll like it here. 80 years old, you're on bicycles and rollerblades, because the Americans don't believe they can die. They don't even think they use the toilet. They call it restroom, bathroom, powder room. It's best to stick to the edges of this country, though. As a foreigner, it's wise not to go too far into the middle. Deep inside this country is a place called the Midwest, and the real piggy Americans live there. They actually have faces like pigs. Their bodies are pink and hairy." So the children, Mo goes out, and the children eventually fall asleep. They go out and they sleep on the deck. And Layla and Zolo are alone as the sun is going down. "I want to go back to the camp, Zolo," Layla says. "We're not going back, Layla. There's a war going on there, remember? It might spill over and then the soldiers would come to the camp." "But what would they do?" "Well, undoubtedly they'd kill everyone, Layla. But what about Mama and Baba?" "Well, they're goners." "Oh my God, I miss Twinkle. She was just a dog." Layla's eyes welled with tears. "Zolo." "Yeso?" "Are there really people like pigs in the middle of this country?" "Oh yes." "We should stick to the edge then." "Yes, we should never lose sight of this specific ocean." "Shut up, frog, go to sleep." Layla closed her eyes and dreamed that the sea was on fire and all the fish beneath her were scrambling to lower depths away from the heat. I'm going to go now to, just a part of, Layla eventually discovers the story of the American Indians. And this is something that she keeps a scrapbook on and it really keeps her going. So I'm going to just read a little part. And she discovers by telling these stories, it gives her power. So she's at the Christmas dinner and she tells the story of, which is actually a true story. "Baby Zero, listen to the story Layla told at Christmas dinner. They all listened. You should too. It's a story that keeps happening, a loop in history, a story I think about. When Layla stole the story, she had the power. The Grand Duke Alexis Alandrovich of Russia came to join in the new white craze of buffalo hunting. The whites thought the buffalo were the most stupid game animal in the world because they were so easy to kill. They were hard to miss with their big sweeping herds carpeting the plains. Custer, the general who liked to kill sleeping Indians on reservations, and Buffalo Bill, who claimed to have killed 4,000 buffalo, were to be the Grand Duke's escorts. They were instructed to make sure he got one buffalo as a trophy. First kill was reserved for the Grand Duke from Russia, of course, the Big Cheese himself, mounted upon a horse armed with a custom-made Smith & Wesson rifle. And of course the buffalo came. The Grand Duke fired 6 shots at one buffalo and missed completely. He turned his attentions to another buffalo, emptied his revolver in the general direction. No joy. The buffalo cruised on implacably. Buffalo Bill, sensing this was going to be harder than he thought, gave the now bulletless Grand Duke his own rifle, whipped his horse so it ran up to the buffalo. Point blank range, Alexis did not hesitate. One buffalo fell dead, and they drank champagne. Strange trio on the plains, Layla wrote in the margins. The Grand Duke, Custer, and Buffalo Bill. Strange trio on the plains, baby Zero. On the last day, Custer told the Grand Duke that they should play a game. They pretended the buffalo were Indians. With the immortal and searing words of Custer, "Boys, here's a great chance for a victory over that bunch of redskins on the other side of the hill," the trio launched their attack, galloped, guns blazing, into the massive herd of giant beasts. Custer's golden ringlets were flying. He was quite a dandy. The Grand Duke adored this game. He managed to shoot a dozen himself. All in all, they killed 50 buffalo, and as usual, took only one as a trophy and left the rest to rot. The Grand Duke, Alexis Alexandrovich, kissed Custer in all the excitement. Kissed him, baby Zero, imagine. The next time Custer led a charge on real Indians, he and his battalion were killed. Indian squaws found his corpse among the dead, and they stuck sharp awls into each of his ears and right through his dead brain and into the center of his head. "Why did they do that?" Zolo said. "They did this," Layla said, "to improve his hearing, because he hadn't listened to them when they told him that if he broke his peace promise, the Everywhere Spirit would cause him to be killed." But the Everywhere Spirit could not help the buffalo. When the railroads were built, the whites would spot the buffalo herds from trains, and all the males would get their guns, hang out the window, shooting for fun. Then someone discovered if you spotted the leader and you didn't kill her but wounded her, the rest of the herd would not leave her but mill around her, so you could wipe out an entire herd in one go without moving your horse. "It shoots today and kills tomorrow," one person said of the efficient new rifles. "You could kill a buffalo from half a mile away with them. Now one hunter could kill 200 buffalo from a single spot, stopping only to piss on his rifle to cool it down and continue to shoot." Orlando A.K. Bond killed 300 beasts in one day and 5,855 buffalo in one outing. He was deafened permanently by the sound of his own rifle. Then they said the very air itself stank with dead buffalo. Then the plains were quiet. The buffalo were gone. The Kiowa Indians said that the buffalo knew they could no longer protect their people, so they had a buffalo council. And the few surviving buffalo were spotted by an Indian woman one morning walking into a mountain that opened up before the last herd. She said she caught a glimpse of a world inside the mountain, and it was the past, the old days, before the settlers and the hunters came. She said the rivers ran clear, not red. The wild plums were in blossom, chasing the red buds up the inside slopes. That's the story, baby Zero. I'm going to skip to this last bit. It's a short piece. And this is the part that's set in Arap, where Marguerite is in, she's on trial in Arap, and she's in prison. And baby Zero, there are three baby Zeros in the book, because each time the regime changes, they turn the year back to zero, as if to erase the past, which is similar in a way to what happened when you arrive in California and everything is so new, but there was, you know, an ancient history beneath the land, so. But everything starts at zero. And some people have asked me where Arap is, but Arap is a sort of, it's a nightmare scenario. It's an example of extreme repression. It's like, Afghanistan under the Taliban, or Guantanamo Bay, or, you know, it's somewhere like that, because I think there's examples of repression in every culture. The Arabs were the first to tell us that zero is nothing, but it's where it all starts. When I think of the future, I think of doors shutting all over the world. So what can I give you? In my lifespan, I saw it go up in smoke. The last wild elephants disappeared. The tigers, the koalas, the bears are gone. We have specimens in the zoo, but a tiger in the zoo is not a tiger. The coral reefs are gone. 50% of the world's species disappeared in my lifetime. There were death announcements on TV. The last gorilla, the last giraffe, most of the insects, all of the frogs, all marched into the great mountain of memory. The whale, of course. We've been waiting for that for a long time. And so we stopped the countdown. It was people like my Uncle Mo, with an insatiable appetite for flamingo tongues, who liked to sprinkle ground down rhinoceros horn in the shark fin soup. He ushered in depletion. The mouse, the cow, the pig, the sheep, the chicken, they're all here with us. Anything we could eat and tame, we kept. But anything that caught our eye is gone. The zebra, the eagle, the bear, the orangutan. And we loved them and we wanted to save them. But we couldn't stop ourselves. The bear surprisingly went for his bladder. The Chinese wanted the bile. The orangutan man of the forest disappeared through loss of habitat as expected. Can we conceive of this loss? Nobody liked the people who wanted to save the world. They were not an appealing cast of characters. They irked me with their single-mindedness, their chasing of causes. At times, I suspected it was akin to fanaticism. That kind of devotion and dedication dried out their lives. But when they lost, I personally resented them for not trying harder. So enter into this depletion. Feel what it is suddenly like to be alive at the tail end of the sixth great extinction. Come in through me. I'll contaminate you with my love, just as my mother loved me. I'll nurture you to leave me. And from your prison crib, you'll see me smile as all mothers do. And all the love in the world will be swirling in that bottomless smile. And my smile will be a dark hole in my face. I know, baby Zero, you sleep inside me now as I await my trial. And I'm feeding you your dreams. But I'm being set up. We're both helpless and at the mercy of those who've shown no mercy. So I'll keep this story going in my head. The ghosts of the past are hungry. I sleep so little these nights. Either you move too much and you lie in my bladder, or the hungry ghosts gnaw through my sleep until my dreams are shredded. Days punctuated only by a guard taking my bucket and leaving food. Everything comes through me, though I am nothing. I should know. I was baby Zero too. Thank you.